Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
The Obama financial bailout. Change or more of the same? Hello again, I'm Oren Alney, and this is Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. George W. Bush spent $350 billion taxpayer dollars to rescue financial institutions. Barack Obama wants up to $1 trillion more. We'll hear how Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner describes the program. Will there be accountability this time? Also on Which Way L.A., with no state budget, California's 58 counties will get IOUs. What does that mean for human services? And Mayor Villaraigosa calls for water rationing. But is there a better way? First, here's the news. Warren Alney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. The lack of a state budget means IOUs instead of state money for counties to provide human services. We'll hear how they're responding. And we'll talk to LA Mayor Villaraigosa about rationing the water supply. Those stories at 7:30 tonight. First, this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner's speech on economic recovery was delayed for a day so President Obama could build support for his stimulus plan. Today, Geithner got what Obama promised, his day in the sun. Conceding that Americans have lost faith in government bailouts, he proposed a package worth $1.5 trillion of combined taxpayer and private money.
But I want to be candid. This strategy will cost money. It will involve risk, and it will take time. But as costly as this effort may be, we know that the cost of a complete collapse of our financial system would be incalculable for families and for businesses and for our nation.
Doug Elliott is a fellow in the Initiative on Business and Public Policy at the Brookings Institution. He's a former investment banker at J.P. Morgan. Doug Elliott, good to have you on our show today.
Thank you very much.
What would you describe as the major elements of the program described today by Secretary Geithner?
Well, you had three or four elements, depending how you want to break it down. First, and I think this was a very positive thing, is they've been honest that we will need to continue to add capital to the banking system, that we as taxpayers will. That's very unpopular, but unfortunately necessary. They've suggested a number of improvements in how they do that, but the most important thing is they intend to keep doing it. The second thing is, in recognition that the banks have been troubled by these toxic assets that they hold, all these mortgage-backed securities and things that have very uncertain values, they have proposed a public-private partnership, still very vague at this point, to try to buy those assets. The idea being that they would engage investment funds with the government, providing presumably some guarantees or subsidies or something, or cheap financing, that would then persuade the private investors to go to the banks and buy those assets and take them off their books. It's still very vague, and my own personal biggest concern is simply it seems very complicated, and I can see a number of ways that it might have serious problems. But we won't know. They're designing it. They say it'll take them several weeks to be able to really tell us what they're thinking of. And then thirdly, they're looking to expand a new program at the Federal Reserve to buy asset-backed securities that themselves are composed of consumer loans of various kinds, student loans. They're talking about including commercial mortgages now, small business loans. What's happened over the last couple of decades is that more and more loans are being made purely for the purpose of making the loan and then packaging them together and selling them on to investors. So mutual funds and folks like that have actually become very significant lenders. But since that securitization market has fallen off very sharply of late, the Fed and the rest of the government are looking for ways to build it up again. So the Fed, with some help from Treasury, is basically offering incentives for investors to buy new issues of these consumer loan asset-backed securities.
So again, then there are these three principal elements, or are there others as well?
There's another which is still pretty vague at this point. They've committed to find a way to use at least $50 billion of the dollars to encourage banks not to foreclose on mortgages. That could end up being paying the banks to reduce the interest rates or cut back on principal, probably on some sort of matching basis where, say, if the bank cuts interest rate by 1%, then the federal government will subsidize another 1%. But that's another one where they say in the next few weeks they'll tell us what they really mean by it.
So, in your opinion, was this somewhat premature? You said that the two of the major elements of it, the manner of acquiring or protecting the banks from the toxic assets and for dealing with the foreclosures, really haven't been elaborated on in any detail.
Well, I have a lot of sympathy for them because this is really complex. But in retrospect, yes, they would have been better off waiting a week or two.
Again, Doug Elliott is a fellow on the Initiative in Business and Public Policy at the Brookings Institution. As taxpayer capital is added to the banks, improvements will be made, at least it was said they would be made, in accountability. Here's a bit of what Tim Geithner had to say about that.
The American people will be able to see where their tax dollars are going and the return on their government's investment. They will be able to see whether the conditions placed on banks are being met and enforced. They will be able to see whether boards of directors are being responsible with the taxpayer dollars and how they are compensating their executives. And they will be able to see how these actions are affecting the overall flow of lending and the cost of borrowing.
Again, that's the voice of the Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner. Elizabeth Warren is chair of the Troubled Assets Relief Program's Congressional Oversight Panel. She's a professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. Professor Warren, good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
You, as the chair of the Relief Program Oversight Panel, have said that the previous administration spent $78 billion more than it needed to on the financial institutions. What do you say about what you've heard today from Treasury Secretary Geithner, particularly in the area of accountability?
Well, I think as our previous reports show, the devil's in the details. You know, it's not that Henry Paulson stood up and said, we're not going to have accountability or we're deliberately going to overpay. Indeed, he said the opposite. It's just that he did something very different. So I see the job of the oversight panel is to make sure that what you do matches up with your rhetoric.
Well, what are the prospects here? What are the best and worst case scenarios given what we heard today?
Well, best case scenario is that, remember, start with a coherent plan. Best case scenario is this is a coherent plan and that it makes some sense and that it really will get us from point A to point B to point C in terms of getting the wheels back on the bus and, you know, getting it out of the ditch and starting to move forward. And that Treasury really will follow through with all of the transparency that it promises. Worst case is that the plan doesn't make much sense when you actually get down to a gritty level with it, and that the promises of transparency are themselves illusory. I mean, you know, it can go either way, and I don't want to jinx anybody. I just, my job doesn't change. My job is to make sure they're doing what they ought to be doing.
Give us a little more background on what happened with the first $350 billion of the bailout and the $78 billion that you feel was excessive. That turned out to be because of the inaccurate evaluation of certain assets. Is that right?
Well, let's pause for a minute on the question about whether
Sure.
or not it's inaccurate. Let me just describe it this way. The Treasury was investing billions of dollars. And we look at the first 10 transactions to start doing our valuation, and getting back stock and warrants for the future. And so we said, okay, we asked Secretary Paulson, who described this as we're protecting the taxpayer and these are, you know, these are good investments. You know, we, American taxpayer is not going to lose any money.
Might even make money.
Might even make money, he said. That's exactly right. I've got all these quotes. So we sent him a letter because one of our very first questions in our oversight report, just are we getting a fair deal? Nobody says we have to make money, and we realize the markets are uneven. Things can happen in the future that we can't tell. But how are we doing? And he wrote back to me, and he said, these are par transactions. And all that means is for every $100 that Treasury is putting into these financial institutions, they're getting stock and warrants back worth $100, at least worth $100 as of the moment of the transaction. Okay, the market brings what it brings in the future, but as of that moment, these were par transactions. That sounds like a fair deal. And we really could have stopped there. But we decided, we thought it was important for the credibility of the whole program that we do an independent analysis. So we got a publicly traded company called Duff & Phelps that does valuations of businesses for other businesses. That's what they do. And we got a couple of academics, finance professor from Yale, finance professor from Northwestern. We got someone who used to head up the pension fund for New York City. And they all got together and said, how do we really value these transactions based on publicly traded data? They used three different ways, lots of fancy stuff, lots of number crunching. And the bottom line was, on average, for every $100 that Treasury put in, we got $66 back in value. Well, you do that enough times, and that adds up, in this particular case, to a $78 billion gift that was made to the banks.
A gift that was made to the banks. Now, you have said that it might have been intentional. They might have been wanting to subsidize the banks to that extent, but that's not what they said they were doing.
Well, that's the real point of this report. It's not that there's no excuse for doing that. You know, it is entirely possible that the Treasury Secretary could have stood up and said, look, our banks are in trouble. I need to take $78 billion and inject it, just give it to them, just a straight subsidy. You could have said that, and then we could have had a good old-fashioned debate about whether or not that made any sense. But instead, they designed a program which was regularly described, which he wrote me a letter, and said, nope, no subsidies here. What we're doing is a straight par investment. We're getting $100 back for every $100 we're putting in. And that means you haven't been straight with the American people. I find it very difficult to believe that Secretary Paulson didn't know that those were not par transactions. And if that's the case, it may be there's good policy reason for doing the subsidization, but I can think of no good policy reason for not being truthful about it.
And if he didn't know, I presume you would say he should have known.
If he didn't know, then actually I'm even more deeply concerned.
What about the fact that he came from Goldman Sachs, from one of the very financial institutions involved in all of this, as do the people now around President Obama?
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons you've got to be cleaner than clean on this. And that's one of the reasons you have to be more transparent. People are right to be concerned about whether or not there are other motivations. And the way we establish that there are no other motivations in terms of the structure of the bailout or how it's executed is by putting it all out front.
Secretary Geithner said this morning that that it was courageous and important that the Congress came up with this money and that the previous administration spent the money the way that it did, implying that things would be a lot worse if that hadn't happened. But what I'm hearing from you is that with all due respect to him, there's no way really to judge whether that's true.
At this moment, it's very difficult to know what data he's looking at in order to draw that conclusion. I mean, we all hear it. But show me the numbers. You know, why do you think that is so? What backs that up? I don't think it's unreasonable to ask that, given the kind of money we're talking about here.
And what about the degree of transparency that he promised today? Is there any way to judge? He said every American would be able to go online and look at the contracts. Most of us wouldn't understand anything about what the contracts meant. What does he need to do to make good on that to you?
Well, the first will be to make the contracts available. You know, this is one of those areas. We, even at the oversight panel, were very, very lucky to have the help of some very talented people. Tim Massad, for example, who volunteered his time, someone who's done these deals on Wall Street for a long, long time, and who came to us and volunteered his time to read through all of the transactions in the first $350 billion and analyze them for us so that we could know what the legal terms were so we could get appropriate valuation. He was helped out by Kat Filosi, also a superb lawyer. So someone can do this. It doesn't mean everyone has to do it for himself or herself. They jump in, they read the documents, they then put their summaries online. For example, the legal summaries of the first transactions that we did, the legal summaries are online at cop.senate.gov, which is our website. And, you know, we very well may put up another one, depending on what the secretary posts. So the good news is, if he follows through and he puts those documents up there, they'll be there, and they'll be there for the public, and we'll find a way to read them. That's not going to be the issue. The issue is getting hold of them and understanding economically what they accomplish. That's going to be the real challenge.
Well, your work is enormously important to many, many millions of people. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us, and I hope you'll be back on future programs.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Elizabeth Warren, a professor of law at Harvard Law School and chair of the Troubled Assets Relief Program's Congressional Oversight Panel. Here's another segment of Treasury Secretary Geithner's speech today.
We believe that access to public support is a privilege, not a right. When our government provides support to banks, it is not for the benefit of banks. It is for the businesses and families who depend on banks, and it's for the benefit of the country. Government support has to come with strong conditions to protect the taxpayer and with transparency that allows the American people to see the impact of those investments.
Bob Scheer is editor-in-chief of TruthDig.com. That's a liberal magazine on the Internet. He's professor of communications at the University of Southern California, and he's author most recently of The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. Bob Scheer, it's good to have you on our program.
Yeah, I don't want to take any time from Elizabeth Warren, who's really she's gone, though. Huh?
She is gone. That was all the time that she could give us.
But, she is the great hero of this whole thing, and you don't have to wait for Treasury to post a new website. You should go to her website, read the COP report, and you'll know what a swindle this has been. I mean, they laid it out. You know, they've had now two major reports on how there's no accountability, and this is the program that Geithner defended today. And he's going to do basically more of the same. I think she was very restrained in her comments. I mean, the critique of her panel has been devastating. And you take, if I can just add something, you know, you mentioned the $78 billion. You know, they're holding back a foreclosure relief program. He said millions of Americans have already lost their home. Everyone knows that's the heart of the whole problem, whether you did the right thing or the wrong thing. If houses are foreclosed on your block, your own property value goes down, et cetera, et cetera. So he said that they're holding back on whether it should be 40 or 50 or how to do foreclosure help. And here they've already wasted $78 billion without anybody even looking at it. But I think the basic point here is that for all of the talk about accountability and transparency, we'll put up an internet site, blah, 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 blah. The fact is they're not asking anything more from these banks now. You know, sure, they can only have a $500,000 bonus, and that's nice window dressing. But in terms of what are they going to do with the money, you know, as Professor Warren mentioned, what are the benchmarks? What are the metrics here? There aren't going to be any. They're not going to be held accountable. And I just found this speech to be absolutely dreadful.
Bob Scheer, again, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com. Doug Elliott's still with us, fellow in the Initiative on Business and Public Policy at the Brookings Institution, a former investment banker at J.P. Morgan. Do you agree with Bob Scheer that this is, in fact, more of the same?
Well, I have to wait and see on that. I mean, the Obama administration clearly is saying they're going to do some things differently. They haven't spelled out that much yet. So I'm afraid it's a little bit early to make a definitive call on that.
The secretary, though, did say the American people have lost faith. He certainly conceded that the kind of perceptions that Bob Scheer is expressing are widespread. So they have to do something, presumably. How far do you think they'll go, and how far will the banks let them go? Do the banks have a vested interest in secrecy?
Well, clearly they do need to address this perception. There's no question, and as you point out, you see Secretary Geithner is very aware that they have to address that because there's no way they're going to have sufficient public support without answering those concerns. I can't speak to how far they will go. In terms of the bank's own interests, I think we probably depend on the bank what they view their own interests as. But I think one of the things A big difference between some people's view of the situation and others is, regardless of how the plan was sold originally, did the real purpose of the TARP plan back in October become stopping a financial meltdown? I do believe that that is what Hank Paulson believes he had to do. And in that circumstance, he took a different approach than many of his critics, which is to say, he looked at the situation and said, there is such a fear that all the banks are going to go down that I don't actually care whether the CEO of a major bank thinks he already has enough capital. I want to make sure every major bank has more capital than it does now so that we can step in, kind of put up a firewall, and stop people from completely losing confidence in the system. And that is a principal reason why the terms of the transactions initially were made on a non-market basis. That is, they were going to force some of the stronger banks to participate, and they didn't feel they would be able to actually do that unless the terms were sufficiently attractive that they could get agreement.
So that explains then the $78 billion that was greater than the PAR transactions would have been, and you're saying
that would explain a piece of it.
So why didn't Paulson say that?
I think that he probably felt that if he were to spell out all the details of it, that it would be difficult to get public support, but that in his view was completely necessary. But I'm just guessing at Paulson's motivations. I can't tell you that. I do know that he was clearly concerned about a complete financial meltdown, and that did have a major effect on the policy choices.
Let me go back to Bob Scheer on that. Do you think that if, in fact, Treasury Secretary Paulson really thought that, that then he did whatever the only thing he could have done, which is to make sure they were participating and give them enough money to do it?
No, look, let's understand the heart of the problem is that because of change in government regulation, which unfortunately Geithner and Summers and these people supported when they were in the Clinton administration and the Republicans supported and Alan Greenspan supported and so forth, we don't know what's in these packages, all right? And that's by design. The Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000 specifically, in Titles 3 and 4, specifically says no pre-existing government law or agency will have jurisdiction over these new hybrid instruments, credit derivatives, and so forth, okay? That will give them, so then people will buy them because the government will not come in and say there's something wrong. That was by design. So Paulson is flying blind, to give him the benefit of the doubt, okay, when he talks about these packages. What Elizabeth Warren's group did is they said, let's open these things up. Paulson's saying, don't open them up. Just give the banks what they need. They'll act better and so forth. Elizabeth Warren, because she has a congressional mandate there, said, no, let's see what's going on in here, which is basically what Paulson didn't want to know. And when she looked in it, she said, wait a minute, you're giving these guys a favor of $78 billion. You know, you're taking this off their hands. And by the way, you throw this figures of $350 million. What Geithner said in his speech today specifically referred to at least a $1 trillion commitment, maybe 50% more, and also another trillion to help the private credit market, you know, student loans and consumer credit and so forth. So we're talking a trillion here, a trillion there. You're talking real money. and you know, gets me really angry, because you talk to all these experts from Wall Street, and they're all very understanding and so forth. But in Geithner's speech, he said millions of people have lost their homes and others are losing their homes. We're not giving them the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, I tell you, go Jon Stewart, you know, Comedy Central route. He said, why not give the money to the homeowners? Why not start on that end of the business? You know, why not order empower bankruptcy judges to make the banks let these people stay in their homes, you know? Why are we starting there? Why are we starting with Wall Street? And that's the assumption that Paulson made, that what, you know, Wall Street wants, Wall Street will get, and they'll solve our problems. Well, they created the problem.
Doug Elliott, back to you, a former investment banker at J.P. Morgan. What about what Bob Scheer said earlier, that it's intentional and by law that the so-called toxic assets are unavailable to any regulatory agency? Nobody even has jurisdiction over them. Should they, in fact, be opened up? Would that be the first step to restoring faith on the part of the American public?
Well, first, just so that people aren't confused, A significant portion of the toxic assets fall in the category that Bob was describing, but not all do.
Okay.
And then secondly, I think everybody recognizes, at least policy people who follow this, that there needs to be significantly greater understanding of those instruments and others like it. You know, there's talk of requiring that many of the derivatives be cleared through a clearinghouse so that there would be a central source of information. Certainly the regulators are going to start requiring substantially more information from regulated institutions about what kind of exposure they have to these instruments. There's even been talk of trying to move as much of this as possible onto exchanges, which are like an equivalent of, say, the New York Stock Exchange, where it would be even more transparent to people.
That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Thanks to Bob Scheer of TruthDig.com and Left, Right, and Center, Doug Elliott of the Brookings Institution, formerly with J.P. Morgan, and Elizabeth Warren of Harvard Law and the TARP Congressional Oversight Panel. In a moment, the state of California won't be paying counties the money they need to provide human services. And Los Angeles Mayor Villaraigosa tells us why he wants to ration the water supply. In a moment on Which Way L.A. Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. California's 58 counties depend on the state to pay for services, many of which are mandated by Sacramento. But Governor Schwarzenegger and the legislature still haven't produced a state budget. Controller John Chung says until there is a spending plan, the counties will have to be satisfied with IOUs. John Tavoloni is on the Riverside County Board of Supervisors. He's also a member of the California State Association of Counties. Welcome to our program.
Hi.
Let me ask you first about Riverside County. When the check doesn't come and the IOU comes instead, what are you going to do?
Well, we have a couple of choices. We cease to deliver the services, which is an option to us, which, you know, is the last thing we want to do because many people depend on these services. And, you know, how do you say to foster kids that they're not going to get, or foster families that they're not going to be given the assistance they needed, or place the kids in the homes? You know, that's one of the issues that is obviously a big concern to us. And then health insurance or health treatment for kids or disability, kids with disabilities, that's another one that is of great concern to us. So we have the option of do we continue the service or do we cease the service? And then if we continue it, then we have to deal with it in terms of taking it out of our reserves, which is obviously something we don't want to do. Counties, Riverside County being a county that put away for a rainy day, we put quite a bit of money away for a rainy day to deal with just the pure economic downturn that we knew was coming. And then the state, because of their mismanagement and gridlock, continuous gridlock and partisan games that they play up in Sacramento, has led to nowhere, actually, and no budget still to date. And we're very, very upset about it. Counties across the state are fed up, and we're not going to put up with it anymore.
Well, now the counties have to send property tax money to the state, do they not? And as I understand it, Los Angeles County is one, and others as well are considering not doing that.
That's correct. That's one of the options that the counties are looking at. L.A. County took the lead in that. In terms of the property tax and other payments that we make to the state. For instance, as court facilities have been transferred back to the state, which we used to operate, now the states operate them, and we have payments that we continue on in terms of operation of those facilities. So we could stop those payments to the state. You know, if they can do it, we can do it. You know, that's what we believe. Will it stand up legally? We're not sure. Those are the options that we're looking at in terms of our ability to withhold payments back to the state.
Is there any effort to go to court and get the controller to send the money rather than the IOUs?
Absolutely. We believe that it is illegal for the controller to withhold monies that have already been appropriated for mandated programs. And that's the lawsuit that Riverside County has authorized to join in with Sacramento and a few other counties. I believe San Diego will be doing the same.
Now, when we say mandated, that's very important because the kinds of things that you were talking about earlier, foster families, health treatment for kids with disabilities and so on, those are mandated by the state. You have to pay those under the law, right?
That's right. Those are programs that the state, through the federal government, passes down certain funds. The state includes certain funds, and we include certain matching funds. That, you know, we provide to oftentimes a disadvantage, but, you know, the disadvantage today or those that are in need today could be anyone because of the economy. So there are people that are on assistance now that, you know, 6 months ago were not because they were, you know, gainfully employed. So yes, their obligations of the state, which are our obligations to provide, because we are the ones that provide the service in the streets, you know, in the streets of our communities, and that's the tough part. How do we continue to provide those services without receiving payment for it? Not many businesses would be able to do that.
If you are talking about the property tax, which you collect and send to the state, couldn't you use that money to pay for the services?
We could. We could. That would require us to withhold that from the state payment. And, you know, would that stand up in court on our side on their side, or on the state side, on the property tax? And would our issue stand up in court in terms of withholding the, not providing the services? We think that we both have some legal ground here to move forward, not only on the property tax side, but on the deferral side.
Your county, Riverside, has had a lot of foreclosures. I assume that's had a big impact on your budgets as well.
It has. It's had a huge impact in terms of assessment values and the reduction in assessment values, failure to pay taxes. Some of the side responsibilities of just ensuring that those property are maintained through code enforcement, you know, that has become a very serious problem. And you know, those are the types of things that, because we knew the economy was going to someday, if not get into a recession, was going to be less active than it was, and I'm talking now 4 years ago, our board put away what we call a reserve for economic uncertainty. Now the state wants to tap into our reserve to pay their obligations and to manage or balance their budget on our backs. And we think that's unfair. We think it's wrong. And what we're saying across the state, our counties, that's the purpose for the joint meeting Thursday, we're going to tell them enough is enough. We're tired of dealing with your gridlock up there. And, they seem to forget, our legislators seem to forget who they represent, and that's the same people we represent. We're all elected by the same people, but they seem to go up to Sacramento, get caught into the partisan battles, which is nonsense and childish, and we're tired of it. And we're going to send that message very loud and clear Thursday.
So you're going, along with other supervisors from counties around the state, to Sacramento on Thursday to make your case in person.
That's correct. I actually am the one who put this meeting together. And, you can probably sense I'm very frustrated, very upset about what's going on. And in discussion with my neighboring colleagues from the various counties across the state and my responsibility to CSAC, I suggest that we do this. We have four full board members that will consist of the joint, it consists of the joint meeting. That's Riverside, San Bernardino, San Diego, and Imperial. And then we have a number of guest supervisors that will be participating with us. Orange County supervisor will be there.
Okay.
Hopefully LA and some others.
Quickly, because we're running short of time, Riverside, as I understand, is going to lose about $17 million this month. Statewide, the counties are going to lose $83 million. That's peanuts by comparison to the $40 billion that the state is said to be in debt. Is that part of your thinking, that this is so little amount of money in terms of state expenditures, they ought to be able to kick it in?
Well, we know they have a severe budget crisis, and we realize that. But the reason they have a severe budget crisis is because they haven't been able to get their act together, and they've overspent, and they've failed to manage efficiently, and that's why we're very, very upset. $17 million is not the accurate number. If the deferrals occur, which we know they will, or we think they will, that's a $30 million hit. To Riverside County each, $33 million hit to Riverside County each month.
Okay, well, John Tavoloni, thank you very much for being on our program.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Again, Riverside County Supervisor and member of the California State Association of Counties are going to be up in Sacramento on Thursday. I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. Rained a lot over the past few days, and there's more to come, but that won't make up for the water shortage in Southern California. Even with restrictions imposed in August, the city of Los Angeles needs mandatory rationing and higher rates for those who fail to conserve. That's according to Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. And, Mr. Mayor, it's always good to have you on our program.
Well, it's good to be on the show, Warren. You said it. I purposely held the press conference yesterday when it was raining to really send home the point that this isn't a temporary drought. This is a three-year drought, and it could end up being a seven-year drought. And the fact of the matter is that we're heading into a crisis that we haven't seen for decades. The state water reservoir levels are at their lowest point since the 76-78 drought, and the Metropolitan Water District is threatening to cut the city's water allocation by 15% to 25%. Colorado River Basin has suffered from 7 years of drought, and court orders are producing permanent cuts in our water supply. So we've got a challenge. We've decided to move from phase one of our plan to phase three. Phase three will limit watering your lawns to 2 times a week. Drastic, yes. Necessary, absolutely. It will also implement what they call shortage year rates. And what those are, it's an effort to use rates to help people, incentivize people to conserve water. It ultimately could reduce everyone's water budget by allowing every customer less water at a cheaper rate. And, of course, those who don't conserve will be penalized.
So in addition to only watering your lawn twice a week, it also limits, does it not, hosing down sidewalks, serving water in restaurants, things of that kind, too?
Those were all measures that were instituted last year as a part of this effort. If you remember the chronology, earlier in the year last year, we did a voluntary measure. And then we did some mandatory conservation. And now we're up in the ante because the climate change and the confluence of forces that I just acknowledged right now have brought us to a situation where we just don't have the water supply we need.
You're also going to double the size of the drought busters force. There are 15 of those people now. Are they actually going to give people tickets and citations?
Yes, but the purpose isn't to generate revenue. The purpose is to, one, make sure that people are abiding by the mandatory effort to conserve, and two, educating people that this is a serious matter and that we've all got to work together. This is the most far-reaching effort of it by any city to address this drought situation, but I can tell you where we go, the other cities will follow.
What about longer-term efforts, such as figuring out ways to retain the rainwater that you held your news conference in yesterday and which we're going to see again apparently later this week? Things of that kind and the use of gray water, proposals of that sort, are you working on those too?
Yes, we are. In fact, I put a plan together that talks about the need to capture stormwater runoff to address the need for water recycling, to do everything we can. In fact, our projections through our conservation plan is to conserve or rather recycle about 6 times what we currently do and address all of our growth needs in the next 30 years through that effort. But even with that, if we don't do something to conserve more water, we're not going to be able to have the water supply that we need.
On another subject, we all know that the state is in terrible trouble and that local governments are as well. You've talked about the need for cuts in the staff in the city, but you at the same time want to continue to increase the size of the police department. Why are you making that decision, and how is it that other services are less important than public safety, just as a matter of principle?
Well, let me just say this, that the number one priority of municipal government, of any government, is the public safety of its citizens. The city's safer than any time since 1956. Property crimes are down in numbers that we haven't seen since 59. the homicide rate down to numbers that we haven't had since 1969.
Well, let me stop you right there. If you've made that kind of progress, then why do you still have to continue to increase the police force when other kinds of services, really important services, are going to have to be cut?
Warren, I'll tell you why. Part of why we've been able to make that kind of progress is we've been growing the police department. Since I've kept my commitment to the people of Los Angeles, when I said we'd grow our department by 1,000 new officers by 2010, we're at nearly 700, and the drop in crime is related to the growth in our police department and the fact that we've made public safety our number one priority. Now, look, we're not saying that we're going to decimate critical city services. What we're saying is that we've got to prioritize what are our core services. We know public safety is a core service. We know that repairing our roads and our streets are core services. We're going to identify core service and make those our priorities. As an example, we spend about $30 million from our general fund every year on a zoo. Is that a core service? Most cities don't own their own zoos. They're public-private partnerships or private altogether. The convention center as well. Many cities have private entities running those, or at least public-private partnerships running those convention centers. We've got to make the city more efficient. We've got to identify savings in a number of areas, and yes, we're going to have to prioritize and say what are our core services, and public safety is without question one of them.
Okay, let me ask you about your re-election campaign. You are running for office. You're not going to debate your opponents. You told the Associated Press, though, that you would not commit to serving out your term. You said you wouldn't make a promise that you couldn't keep. Why should people vote for you if they think that the mayoralty is a stepping stone to some other office?
Well, first of all, what I said is that some 4 years ago, I said that I wouldn't run for mayor when I ran for city council. I learned from that experience. And I do want to remind you that despite the fact that many pundits took umbrage with it, the people of the 14th Councilmanic District voted overwhelmingly for me for mayor. But I learned from that. And so all I said was, I'm committed to this job. I'm committed to re-election. People are going to make a decision about whether or not I should be able to get another 4 years based on what I've done in the last three and a half. And I think what we've done is we've kept our promises, whether it was in the issue of public safety. The city's the second safest big city in the United States of America. Crime is down to lows that we haven't seen.
Okay, but let
years.
Me ask you this. If you're not going to commit to serving out the term, shouldn't you at least debate your opponents so people know what the choices are?
Well, what I've said is I'll let my record stand for whatever I might say in a debate. Remember, it would be a debate with 10 people where all of you get about 3 or 4 minutes to be able to make your case. I'm going to contact voters. I've opened up an office on the east side. I'm opening up an office in South
LA. What about Mr. Moore, the one who has the one who's raised the $200,000? At least he has a campaign war chest. Why don't you debate him?
Well, like I said, I'm focusing on talking to voters directly. I've looked at my record, and I think my record speaks for itself. And I think my hope is that people will agree. I was starting to say I will be knocking on doors. I will be calling voters, but I won't be debating the 10 candidates that you mentioned.
All right. Antonio Villaraigosa, the mayor of Los Angeles, as always, good to talk with you, and we'll look forward to the next time. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Warren.
All that rain we've been seeing this month isn't helping, as we heard earlier, because the water gets washed away in storm drains and ends up polluting the seas and the beaches, but it could be recovered. Technology is not just available, but in place at 2 parks, 2 schools, and at least 1 single-family home. Andy Lipkus is founder and president of Tree People, which advocates conserving the rains and has figured out ways to do it. And Andy Lipkus, it's always good to talk with you.
It's
great to be talking to you again.
We heard from the mayor that he'd like to take a look at some of these long-term proposals. What would it take to save a significant amount of water in the way that you're doing it in the parks, the schools, and at least one home?
Well, I think it will take ramping up and using even this economic stimulus package for infrastructure and saying, hey, we want to begin retrofitting the city for the future. And by the way, the good news is the mayor has provided the leadership, and instead of Tree People being an independent critic, we're because of the leadership, the Department of Water and Power is working closely with us and actually beginning to study this.
Tell us about this technology. Tell us what you're doing at the parks particularly.
Well, we're capturing, harvesting the rainfall and either storing it in cisterns, large tanks, or if the soil is right, as it is in the northeast San Fernando Valley, the water's going right back in the aquifer, our greatest natural storage device that's under the city, the groundwater. So in Sun Valley and in Pacoima, we've both in Sun Valley Park, working with Los Angeles County Public Works Watershed Management Division and the LA City Rec and Parks and the city's Watershed Protection Division. So a multi-agency partnership retrofitted Sun Valley Park. It captures a huge amount of water. I believe the capacity is close to 2 million gallons underneath that park. So we, the county actually funded for $5 million, but this retrofit, taking out lots of soil, putting in a whole underground structure that the water, flood water, comes to the park, goes through a very sophisticated filtration system, is cleaned, and then it goes underground into these chambers. Looks almost like a parking lot underground. And then the water very quickly goes back into the aquifer, but it's only clean. And on the surface, the community got an enhanced park with lighting, lighted soccer fields, so more park and recreation space. Similarly, in a school in Pacoima, all the school used to flood. And what we did was bring in DWP, who sort of matched the funding that the city, that the school district was going to spend just to replace asphalt, and instead made a sustainable school, a model demonstration project, and captures all the rainfall. It gets cleaned and goes underneath the schoolyard into a chamber. Then the water goes into the aquifer. Now, down the southern end of the city near Los Angeles Airport, the Open Charter School, the soil is like clay there, and water can't percolate through it. So instead, with a grant from the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Project and partnership from the city and the school district, that school put a big cistern in, 120,000-gallon cistern, that captures all the rainfall, and the water then is held in that big tank and then directly supplies the irrigation system for a beautiful green schoolyard and green swales throughout the whole campus and many, many more trees.
Andy Lipkus, we just have a very short time left. What would it take for people to have cisterns at their homes? How difficult would it be for them? How would the system work, and how much rainwater would you be able to save? How much of a dent would it make in what's referred to as a shortage?
Well, we've retrofitted one house in South LA where we put in a cistern that would actually fits along the fence line, and that one stores 3,700 gallons, but we're hoping that we could see local manufacturing of cisterns that could hold 10,000 to 20,000 gallons per house. Plus, even easier, you can actually begin to change your landscape. So as the mayor said, we can actually profoundly reduce our water use, capture the rainfall in the landscape, and either put it in the ground or put it in a cistern. It's not that hard to do. What we think is needed is a citywide, a region-wide program that begins to invest. If you will, if you could imagine a cistern that was like networked like network computer storage, they would just have a remote-controlled switch. So the Department of Water and Power and the Flood Control Agency could both have access to it. It would be a shared-use thing. That way public resources could be invested. Just in the same way that the city and the Metropolitan Water District invested in swapping toilets, giving people $75 to replace their toilet. That has saved the city. It's reduced water use by 30%. That same kind of build-out
in a visionary infrastructure package could make a resilient, climate-resilient, climate-protective system throughout Los Angeles. And we're hoping to see something like that happen. That's why we've been building the demonstration project.
Is there some way to talk about this in macro terms and compare what lifestyles might be like if you instituted a system like that as opposed to what they are now, even with the climate change?
Well, if we don't do something like that, we are going to see radically, radically altered brown lifestyles. I think it's possible to live much, much more water efficiently. And by the way, you mentioned gray water. It is another viable system, could be a system-wide retrofit. And we know, because we're working in partnership with DWP, they're starting to evaluate that. Those people who want to do it right away, though, can actually get guidance from the gray water gorillas. There's a website, Gray Water Gorillas, that gives instructions on how to easily take water from your washing machine, pretty clean water right out to your garden so you can start to save it. But the future, how we survive climate change and have, by reducing our water use with much more beautiful and much more productive landscapes, but that use a lot less water and harvest the rainfall, which we think could replace more than half the water we're having to import.
Okay, that's really what I wanted to get at. That's an enormous figure
and
easily available is what you're saying.
Yeah, it takes a commitment and leadership to say we're going to go in this direction.
Okay.
And we think we can get there.
Andy Lipkus, founder, president of the Tree People, always good to talk with you.
Great to talk to you, Warren. Thanks.
Producer of Which Way LA, Gary Scott, Christian Bordahl, and Sonia Geis. Our managing producer is Karen Reds, and our technical director, Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayla. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for Which Way LA, 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.